Sanheverim. My friends, it was the French philosopher and historian Montesquieu who said, "Happy the people whose annals are tiresome." How truly he spoke. Yet, tiresome is a word that could never be applied to the annals of Israel. On the contrary, Israel's history has fascinated multitudes of all nations down the centuries. It is unfortunately equally true that the word happy could scarcely be employed to describe the sustained condition of the people of Israel throughout the ages. Truly, neither tiresome nor happy are the annals of Israel. Of course, the same could be said of other nations, but, as we have seen in my previous messages, Israel alone, as a nation, received a divine call to perfect a divine purpose. But Israel's self-written history is frank acknowledgement of poor performance. Yet Israel's poor national performance did not frustrate the divine purpose, but it did charge Israel's annals with experiences neither tiresome nor happy. Nevertheless, the nation's history weaves a clearly discernible and perfect pattern of the unfolding drama of divine world redemption. Thy kingdom come. This is no vain petition, of that I am persuaded. And the Jewish people and the nation of Israel are inextricably woven into that divine redemptive purpose. We shall see all this in that God-inspired volume, very erroneously designated the Old Testament, but which would be more correctly titled the Book of the Divine Kingdom, and which is affectionately known to us Jewish people as the Tanakh. The Tanakh reveals that in the more than 1,200 years of Israel's checkered history before the Common Era, there have been tragic captivities and glad restorations. These historic circumstances were invariably used by the eternal God of Israel to speak to the nation a message of hope regarding a great, final restoration. Indeed, no dark night of Israel's annals was left unrelieved by the bright gleam of future promise. In Israel's vicissitudes, three captivities stand out prominently. You will be familiar with them. The Egyptian captivity of 215 years from 1706 to 1491 BCE, from which captivity Moses delivered Israel. Then, the Assyrian captivity in 722 BCE, from which there was no deliverance. And, thirdly, the 70 years Babylonian captivity. The ancient Babylon power was the rod in the hand of the eternal God by which he chastised the southern Israel kingdom of Judah. Yet, at the same time, through his prophecies, by the mouth of Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Daniel, the ultimate overthrow of Babylon itself was predicted. This overthrow took place in the year 538, before the Common Era. To this date, 2 years must be added for the beginning of the separate reign of Cyrus the Persian, and thus we have the 70 years from 606 to 536 BC, which was the historic fulfillment of Jeremiah's famous prophecy of the 70 years Babylonian chastisement, as pre-announced by him and recorded in chapter 29 and verse 10 of the book bearing his name. Thus, Israelitish history knows only two Exodus movements, one into Palestine from Egypt, and the other, some 950 years later, into Palestine from Babylon. Fortunately, we can assess the magnitude and quality of the Babylonian Exodus, as history provides us with the most minute detail of the venturesome pilgrims who embarked on that 4 months' migration across the forbidding and unsympathetic desert in the year 536 BCE. In this first stage of the return from Babylon, of all the multitude of captives, only a mere 42,360 returned, besides 7,337 slaves and 4,000 priests, with a protecting escort of 1,000 cavalry. Something of the ecstasy of those returning to Israel from the Babylonian captivity may well be captured from Psalm 126. When the Eternal turned again the captivity of Zion, we were like them that dream. Then was our mouth filled with laughter, and our tongue with singing. Then said they among the nations, the Eternal hath done great things for them. The Eternal hath done great things for us, whereof we are glad. So in the second year, that is, in B.C. 535, the foundation of the second temple was laid amidst difficulty and opposition. Hence the edifice was not finished until B.C. 516, 20 years after the return. Some 78 years after this first stage, in the year 458 B.C.E., Ezra led a caravan of perhaps some 5,000 souls back to Palestine in the second stage of the return from Babylon. Then, in the year 445 BCE, Nehemiah completed the return, being himself, as a matter of fact, almost the final installment. Now, I know that this brief peep into Israel's annals has been sufficiently interesting to you in itself. But let me confess, I have an additional reason for disclosing its details. You will remember that in my last message, we paid a breathless and exciting visit to the very center of this third captivity, the awe-inspiring ancient city of Babylon. We paid this visit in order to view the scene and circumstance out of which our great Jewish prophet, Ezekiel, uttered his amazing prophecies of the final restoration. For it was to Ezekiel, in Babylon, that a wealth of dramatic detail was divinely vouchsafed regarding the new Israel and the future messianic kingdom. Now, here is the point of my present message. My friends, careful examination of all the Ezekiel prophecies and an equally careful examination of Jewish national history reveals that it is quite impossible to pour the full volume of Ezekiel's predictions into the very limited dimensional capacity of the meager return of Israel from the Babylonian captivity. There is a great residue of prophetic detail which overflows the mere historic vessel. Thus, when we measure the magnitude and meaning of Ezekiel's prophecies against the historic Babylonian return, we find that the prophetic foot will not fit into the historic boot. The boot is too small for the foot is too large for the boot. What then are we to do with this situation? Well, perhaps we should admit that some interpretations have been ingenious and others wild and fantastical. Shall we follow some and tear the historic boot apart, and force the prophetic foot into a boot thus mutilated? Or shall we follow others and surgically amputate not a few parts of the prophetic foot to make it fit the historic boot? I confess both these suggestions are unnatural and unsatisfying. Don't you think so? Personally, I prefer equally to avoid a mutilated historic boot and a disfigured prophetic foot. Yet the phenomenon to which I refer remains. Is there an explanation? Of course there is. A reasonable and a proven one. Theoretically and theologically, it is known as the canon of double sense, by which is meant that a first historic accomplishment, chronologically near at hand, employs some of the properties of the total predictions without necessarily absorbing or exhausting them, but leaves the prophetic total itself to an occasion chronologically more remote. Thus, the earlier historic movement becomes married to the initial predictive prophecy preceding it, to combine with it in forming an even more formidable attestation and assurance of full historic fulfillment of the total content of the prediction in the more remote occasion. Rest assured, my friends, that Rabbi Dr. S. Fish is absolutely correct when he says that Ezekiel predicted not only the return from the Babylonian exile, but also the ultimate redemption and regeneration of Israel in a distant age in the future. Yes, the rabbi has correctly applied the canon of double sense to the Ezekiel prophecies, and now, with our shared knowledge of this proven principle of prophetic interpretation, we shall be better able, in my next message, to assess the current restoration of Israel and its possible relation to a mighty, menacing power north of the newborn state. Yivarecha Adonai v'yishmerecha, Ya'er Adonai panav eleha v'hunecha, Yisar Adonai panav eleha, V'yaseim lecha shalom. The Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace. Amen.